Hello, Squawker Talker listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Squawker Talker Football Podcast. It's this simple. By this time next week, we'll all know the winners of the 2019 Women's World Cup. We will know which medal-related Lucy Bronze pun has been tweeted multiple times, by myself mainly, and we will also know if the predictions that I'm going to ask the expert Squawker Talker podcast guests are correct. So first of all, I need to introduce those very guests, and we've been reduced to two again. First of which is chief writer, Copa America extraordinaire, Mohammed Butt. Welcome.
I'm happy to be back on the Squawker Talker.
And yeah. We're hammering home, in case you'd forgotten the name. We're really trying to push out to make sure people know Squawker Talker.
I enjoy being called a Squawker Talker podcast guest. I enjoy that. That's very good.
The Squawker Talker football podcast.
It's going to be a very good podcast that's called the Squawker Talker.
And as you've heard Will correcting Mo on the full title of the podcast, Will Hall is also joining us, ready for some more Serie A antics, I think, you've got lined up.
Yeah, true.
Very
all
planned.
That is true.
But as I said, first up, it is the big one. United States, the favourites, take on England in a match already being described as on this Tuesday.
Oh, that's a nice reference.
But Mitchell and Webb references aside, this is actually a huge game. And with so much more behind it, given the incredible week and tournament Megan Rapinoe has had herself. And also a point that I thought was we're being denied not just a good football match, but an aesthetically beautiful football match. Because Nike revealed that the women's home shirt, the US women's team, is now their all-time top-selling jersey ever.
In a single season, yeah.
In a single season. And England's away kit this season for the World Cup, I believe, was one of the best ever produced. But I was looking at the sides round, and we might be denied a battle of the best kits because USA are technically away side. So that could be them wearing their red. I've not seen anything official. Hopefully we will be given the battle of the kits. In United States versus England, but beyond the kits, actually on the pitch, this is a pretty massive game. I obviously got complete Norway predictions wrong. Carolyn Graham Hansen was not too effective. In fact, bulldozed by the right hand side of Lucy Bronze, who Phil Neville called afterwards the best player in the world. She will now be taking on Megan Rapinoe, a world class footballer, according to Phil Neville himself as well. England 3-0 Norway, USA 2-1 against the hosts. Mo, is it going to be Megan Rapinoe's show once again? She scored the last four goals for the USA in the World Cup. Is that going to be the same thing against England?
I don't know. It's interesting because obviously on the one hand, I don't really think England have faced a player like her. Obviously, Carolyn Graham Hansen is phenomenal, but I think Rapinoe has this sort of ability to just impact games. I mean, she's so experienced. She's played so many games. I mean, she's won the World Cup before, won the Olympics before. She's won two CONCACAF Women's Championships. She's really a pure veteran, and she's playing. She's the captain. She's one out there wearing the armband. She's playing. She's leading from the front. And unlike Graham Hansen, who is a magnificent dribbler, but who necessarily doesn't have the sharpest shot in the world, the most devastating final cut. Rapinoe is excellent in the final third, coming alive. Her set pieces are dangerous, as we saw, against France.
Yep.
She can really make a difference. But equally, she doesn't really defend that much because she's 33 now. So Lucy Bronze and Nikita Paris could actually have a bit of a field day up against Crystal Dunn. Although, again, as a response to that, Crystal Dunn is phenomenal at making recovery tackles because Diani completely and utterly stitched her up repeatedly when France played the USA, but she constantly got back and made a tackle or a block or something. Like, the amount of times Diani dribbled by her, you would have thought France would 100% create something from there, but they didn't really because her recovery tackling and her recovery instincts. Remember, she plays number 10 for her club football, Crystal Dunn. So for her to be so tuned in defensively really speaks volumes to her quality. So it's going to be really that. I mean, look, not to discount the rest of the pitch, because obviously there are other players out there. Yes. But so much of the action is going to be located on that flank, England's right-hand flank, America's left. So much of the danger, so much of the quality of the game is going to be on that pitch. But the one thing is, on that right flank, England might win it. In the rest of the pitch, I think that's where I think the USA will have the advantage, have the edge. Rose Lavelle, bringing Lindsay Horan off the bench. They're going to have Julie Ertz will probably start again, and she'll sit on Frank Kirby and shut Frank Kirby down the way she did to Tini. It's hard to look past USA.
It's this USA team as well. They've got seven players with beyond 100 caps. I know they're not all starting at the same time. And a lot has been said about the USA's squad rotation, and the manager's actually been criticised a bit. I've been seeing people almost saying that she's getting away with certain decisions because of the vast amount of quality in that US squad. But an interesting point as well is that it's now England that have conceded the fewest goals in the tournament, just the solo one in the opening game. And all of the stuff about we were discussing before, England not potentially looking the best, almost getting better with each game, they keep improving and they keep sort of proving everyone else wrong that's saying, oh, maybe this might be a step too far. So my question is it going to be a step too far, or is this the chance for Lucy Bronze, who, as I said, Phil Neville saying, best player in the world, has reached levels at fullback that I could never dream of reaching myself as a player. Emerging as a candidate for player of the tournament, if she can lead England past this juggernaut of a US team, Will, yeah, in the semi-final, she's probably got that nailed on, I guess.
An England win on Tuesday would likely make her favourite, or indeed whoever wins that game will make the respective player favourite. What we know is that the winner of USA-England will be the highest ranked team in the final. We could speculate that the golden ball will go to a member of the team that wins the World Cup. Only twice has it gone to a player for the runners-up, China's Sun Wen in 1999, Marta, Brazil 2007. So as Mo's already gone over, many are picking out this battle between Megan Rapinoe and Lucy Bronze as something that could decide Tuesday's semi-final. And as you've said there, England is sort of improving incrementally, and Bronze is a player who has themselves improved incrementally. There were doubts as to whether she was on top of her game before the Norway win. So some will consider golden boot chat maybe a bit reactive. Critics, who I'd probably disagree with, may suggest her claim is heavily based on one performance. But the quality of being able to raise your game incrementally and in conjunction with the increasing quality of opponents is a valuable characteristic in tournaments, tournament format competitions, and something that also mirrors the story of Bronze's season at Lyon. She said in a recent interview that training against the world's best strikers every day improved her, and that even at the start she said she couldn't get anywhere near the ball in training, but then after a month got up to speed. And that's, you would assume, primed her for going up against the world's best players in the USA.
I mean, you're training against Ada Hegerberg every day. You're going to learn. Yeah, you're going to work on your defending.
I was going to say, that Norway team she faced was bread and butter if she'd been facing the Norwegian wasn't there.
And so, yeah, I think this battle between Rapinoe and Bronze is symbolic of more, has been picked up on because these are two players who have like come into their own in these knockout stages. As Mo said a second ago, Rapinoe scored the last, or you said actually, sorry, to correctly credit the,
cool,
the person.
Mo
made that
usually
point.
Steals it directly, but now you're just misdirecting
the
credit.
The middleman scored the last four goals for USA. Lucy Bronze, who's just, you can see through her dribbling the way she can drive England up the pitch, and then her interplay with Paris, Kirby or Scott also stands out.
All three goals against Norway were hers. Assist, pre-assist, and goal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, she's phenomenal.
She's, in fact, completed the most dribbles of any player, I think, at the whole tournament, definitely during the knockout phase with eight. And only two players in the knockout phase attempted more passes, ending in the final third, both of whom were forwards. The caveat hit there being that by Bronze's own admission, she misplaced quite a few in that first half versus Norway. But in any case, Bronze is in the top three for a key metric that's used to assess the quality of like playmakers. Mm. And in that context, it's hard to argue against England's right back having functioned as the team's most effective playmaker in the knockout stages. And then when you consider that she's one of only three players to assist more than one goal during the knockout stages, so since the group stage concluded, you can make a credible case that she's been the knockout stage's most effective playmaker on a winning side. So much so, in fact, Neville, it's not the first time he's called her the world's best player. He's been sort of obviously trying to G up her confidence over the course of the tournament. He's also made a habit out of trying to make mind games his thing, as we saw with Houghton and Bright. Yeah. The suggestions they might not be fair, but he's also suggested that she might slip into midfield for this USA game. So we can take that with a pinch of salt, as I said, due to this sort of track record of playing mind games. But
I think moving her away from the key battle we identified could be dangerous in itself.
There's two ways of looking at it. She might get pinned back less.
Yep.
If you play a more defensive option there, then she can sort of influence the game a bit more. But like you say, it could go two ways.
I just feel in the sense that, and obviously as USA are definitely a level up, the sort of final boss compared to Norway, but... I was talking about my analysis of the game was like they have to double up and be very careful about put someone on Carolina Graham Hansen themselves. And what England did instead was said, right, you can stay there, but we're going to absolutely bombard you with the whole flank that you're meant to be covering. And you either have to come back and then you lose your thrust going forward, or we'll just be so relentless that any time you do get the ball, we've already punished you. And that's what they did. Jill Scott's goal was the fastest ever for England in a Women's World Cup. And that set the tone completely. And immediately then, England, that goal, I think, was so key in them progressing, because it sort of got rid of that entire narrative that we constructed on the podcast about how it would be sending her down the gauntlet. Immediately, they were on the back foot, and England could, as I said, be relentless on counter, and Lucy Bronze almost a one-person counter.
Yeah, I mean, that was the trick. And I think that's what they have to do against USA as well, because obviously the temptation is let's sit back, let's absorb, you know, Phil Neville, I don't know how, like I said, Will says he plays mind games, maybe you do move Lucy Bronze into midfield and put a defender, pure defender against Megan Rapinoe. But to me, that's a mistake, because Rapinoe has one weakness, is that she's 33 years old, she doesn't track back. She's not gonna, she can't really. She didn't do it against France. And basically, Crystal Dunn's miracle performance, they got away with it, right? You know, against England, if you're Phil Neville, you're looking at that, you should be saying, look, you're the younger player, Lucy Bronze, you're the younger player, you impose yourself on her, you go forward, she's not going to track you back, she'll stay up there. So the USA will be, you know, you can basically go, you and Nikita can go 2-on-1 against Crystal Dunn.
I think that's the key point, because it was very much sort of Diani beat her 1v1, and then we'll hope. The interplay on that fullback, there were some occasions where they did get a few crosses in, but I feel like there wasn't the same level of synergy we've seen from England. So Crystal Dunn there might be able to deal with Nikita Paris or Lucy Bronze
at the same
in a
time.
1v1, but you're not going to get past... 1-2 is the simple and most deadliest weapon in football, and England have nailed that on that right side. So you can get past any 1v1 defender with that simple
trick. Of course,
trick.
The trick is the USA centre-backs are very good at heading the ball away. They were very, very good against France. And if Julie Ertz is playing, as I suspect she will, she'll drop in, make it a 3. So it's not, like you said, USA are a level above. They are the best team in the world. They were coming into the tournament. They probably, it's not going to be easy for England, but there is a chance. There is definitely a chance. The only worry for England, as far as I can tell, is that so far, all the teams that have the star players have been losing. France had Amandine Henry, they lost. Norway had Carolina Graham Hansen, they lost. So everyone has a sort of star attacking player. The only other team that's surviving like that is the Dutch, and they've got Lincoln Martins, and they're going up to Sweden next. I mean, who the hell knows what happens there? So.
Well, I was going to move us on to the second semi-final anyway, and you've done it perfectly there. I was going to lead with the fact that whoever wins between England and USA will likely see themselves as favourites. Will, you mentioned that they're going to be the highest ranked side.
Yeah.
So this could be, if you get past this, then it all almost becomes so close to reality. But in Netherlands and Italy, Netherlands have won major tournament, I think 11 major tournament games in a row, going
European
back to
champions.
Their European Championship success.
Yeah.
So despite the fact they haven't looked at flowing best or the most dangerous team, they've got a 22-year-old striker who has scored 235 goals in 278 games for club and country in Vivian Miedema.
She's a bit good, mate.
Well, so good that I think Will wrote Mida Majestic as a pun.
You were letting them behind the curtain.
Pun for me to write down, because you can tell that I was annoyed. I didn't think of it myself. So I've tried to give credit there. But that's what she has been, and her header was brilliant. But it again stems from excellent set piece delivery. Yeah. It looks like that's going to be Netherlands' game plan again.
Just to touch on Miedema, she is a pure poacher, because she was awful in that game against the Italians. Really, just a non-event. Looked, her touch was off. There was a chance where she could have played Lika Martins in for a 1-1, and she took a shot. And you're thinking, oh my god, what is this? Because she's been playing so well, and then when they needed it most, up she popped with a goal. Great goal, really fantastic header. But Sharida Spitzer's set piece delivery was the key. Assisted the first goal, assisted the second goal as well. That's 4 in 3 games for her, the last 3 games. She's really stepping up now. She's got the most assists in the tournament. And that set piece delivery is really something, because even if the Dutch attack isn't flowing as you would want it to, and with Van der Sanden playing so poorly, You know, it may struggle at times, but they can always win set pieces because Lika Martins in particular is a great dribbler, yeah. very good at drawing contact. And with set pieces, with Spitzer around, they've always got a chance. That's going to really benefit them against Sweden because Sweden are a very good defensive outfit. No team, every team in the quarterfinals that scored first won except for Germany. They took the lead against Sweden. Excellent, excellent goal from Lina Magul. Really, really, if you can find it on YouTube, if you watch it, just go watch it. It's an amazing little, the ball comes through to her, she flicks it up and volleys it home through the goalie's legs. It's sensational. And I thought when that happened, I was like, oh, here we go. Germany going to run riot. Let me start writing flowing prose about that goal. And then in the end, it didn't happen. Sweden rallied. They stayed solid. They exposed the German centre-backs who had been kind of ropey all tournament, but have kept hadn't conceded until the quarterfinals. Everyone was like, oh, yeah, they're good. Yeah. They really weren't good. They really relied on Dawson's recovery pace so much. And, you know, that wasn't a factor, basically, against the Dutch. And so I think the Swedes are really a formidable opponent because, I mean, Blackstenius is finally coming into her own. She scored 2 goals in consecutive tournament games for the first time in her career. So if she hits form, goal scorers can change everything. You know that. The Dutch's defense is quite vulnerable. The Italians never really managed to show it on the break. But the Swedes, as we saw against Germany, very good in transition, good long direct balls. Blackstenius is very dangerous. So is Jakobsen.
I was going to say, on Blackstenius there, again, I saw a lot of people reviewing that performance and saying that she was just an absolute powerhouse, impossible to deal with. And there you said she scored in back-to-back knockout games, the first Swedish player to do that since 1991. If she does make it 3 in a row, she will make history and become the first Swedish player to do that. So she's got something to sort of prove there, and it almost will be a battle of those strikers because, as you said, she very much leads the Swedish counter-attack and is difficult to deal with, whereas Miedemar, with Netherlands having more of the ball, more overall quality, she's there to apply the finish.
I mean, yeah, with Lika Martins on the ball, I mean, you're not going to, you know, so she's going to be the one leading the Dutch team. But again, Sweden's defence is very solid. If they can, you know, it's going to be really fascinating watching that, but that might be quite a low-scoring one, whereas I think US, there might be a lot of goals in USA. You know, I think Sweden, Netherlands might be quite 1-0, maybe, you know, something quite low-scoring. Yeah. So they're really interesting to watch, and both sides, especially Sweden, will create a really interesting matchup in the final because they won't be as good, obviously, as either England or USA, but they'll be solid and defensively and playing on the break, and it could be a really interesting matchup kind of final. You know what I mean?
Well, here it is then. To round off that quick review, and again, there's so much more to dip into, which we will do when the tournament's finished itself. A quick shout for Megan Rapinoe's probably the most iconic celebration at the World Cup so far.
But yeah, have that, Donald.
Probably this. Probably in recent memory. Incredible. The pictures are incredible of that. I just love that. But will she... Well, she's obviously in the running to win Golden Boot, maybe player of the tournament because of her performances in the knockout stages, the tournament itself, and confine England to not a... USA have had a podium finish all the time. England obviously will be hoping for that. So my questions, the predictions that were mentioned earlier, is who do you think is going to win the tournament? Then who will pick up the Golden Boot? Who's going to pick up player of the tournament? And where, as a one for the home fans, where will England finish in all of this? We can start with you, Will, if you're ready.
Okay, England have finished third after a third place playoff win, in keeping with their FIFA ranking. She's third as well. I just think that the USA have the smarts, the know-how, the organisation, and the ruthlessness to punish England in a way that they haven't been punished during the tournament for these slack passes in the back line. Bardsley's been criticised for her ability with the ball at her feet for the entirety of the tournament. Bright, we saw that pass against Norway that could have been so much worse.
Steph Houghton
in the first game, I think, made the mistake that led to the goal conceded against Scotland, and then recovered really well from that. Since then, she's been solid, and that last ditch recovery tackle we saw,
and the goal line clearance as well.
But all of this is just the kind of stuff that you could see a experienced team like USA punishing England for. I think you could maybe make the case that the mentality for England is different. It's changed now. Neville has, in fact, been making that point during the whole of the tournament. It's like they're not happy to be in the semi-final. The mentality is kind of all or nothing. They want to inspire the nation and by winning the World Cup and, you know, having that sort of positive societal effect with promoting the women's game. But USA favourites, I think that one will go by the script. I think they'll be playing Netherlands in the final. And I think the top goal scorer is going to be Rapinoe, because you can probably bet on there being another penalty in this tournament after what we've seen from VAR so far.
Although VAR reversed its blooming decisions, didn't it? France robbed of a handball.
I mean, yeah, that was that would have been a handball two games earlier.
Mo, what about your predictions for those things?
I think Lucy Bronze is the best player at the tournament, second best player in the world. It's not going to do England any good. I think they will dominate their right-hand flank, but I think the USA will absorb their pressure. The defenders are really, really, really good, and they'll win it somewhere else. Maybe Alex Morgan will come back to life after, you know, she's been injured, carrying a knock, and since the first game. Maybe Tobin Heath. There's too much quality and experience, man. They can bring Lindsay Horan off the bench. That's ridiculous. I think USA will win that maybe 3-1, 3-2.
You guys are hanging yourselves out to dry. I asked for...
And I reckon,
you're giving me the whole predictions of the breakthrough. You can just tell me the winner...
Netherlands going to win 1-0 against Sweden. Right. Miedema's going to score again. Off a set piece again. And I think the final, I reckon England will finish third. They'll beat the Swedes in the third place, but because they'll be really hungry to make an impact. And Lucy Bronze is too good for Sweden. Sweden. And I think the final USA will beat Netherlands like handily. I think Lieke Martins will play well. Miedema might score, but USA will have too much. I think Megan Rapinoe, player of the tournament, golden ball. Yeah, golden ball, golden boot, golden medal. Stuff you, Donald Trump. And definitely not going to the White House. Because why would you?
There you go. Politically charged golden trio of Megan Rapinoe there. And with that, we'll be moving on from the Women's World Cup. And we're going to do, because there is so much football, we're going to do a quick wrap-up of everything else going on that you might have missed before diving into some transfer fun. So take a little break, and then I'll be back with some roundup of tournament football. As promised, now there's going to be a little breakdown of the tournaments going on at the moment, starting with Copa America, which will also run concurrently with the Women's World Cup. We'll be discussing that on the next week podcast. But in case you had missed it, who is in the semi-final? You have Brazil versus Argentina, which will be 1:30 in the morning on Wednesday, after Brazil's 4-3 penalty shootout win against Paraguay. Alisson is yet to concede a goal from open play, and that looks like it could continue against what is not really an unstoppable force in Argentina. Lionel Messi, yet to score or assist from open play, has scored one penalty, but it looks like it's been Lautaro Martinez as the main reason why Argentina are pushing forward in the competition. He scored twice, joint top scorer, but with 9 other players. Argentina, obviously, were the only quarterfinalists to score in their game, winning 2-0 against Venezuela. But Brazil-Argentina, obviously, probably the final everyone wanted. But it's not, because we have Copa America legends, really, Chile, and we're going to be moving on to those at the end of the podcast. They are taking on Peru, who beat Uruguay on penalties after another 0-0. And which everyone was pleased for, because it was sweet, sweet justice.
The bill comes due for Luis Suarez. Yeah. Finally, after 2010 and all the antics at that World Cup, finally, he missed the penalty in a shootout.
All antics leading to this. Luis Suarez left in tears on the pitch, just as he was at Selhurst Park all those years ago as well.
Probably at Anfield as well this season.
Yeah, he's probably just been crying a lot on pitches. He's a very emotionally charged player. But it won't be Uruguay, who, again, were looking like they had a real chance to win this. It's going to be Chile versus Peru in the semi-final. Chile will be looking very eager to make another final. Alexis Sanchez, of course, is a different player in the Chile kit and has been directly involved in 3 goals. Colombia were knocked out without conceding a goal in normal time, despite having David Ospina in goal, which was surprising. It was a 5-4 penalty shootout for Chile in that. So they set up a semi-final against Peru, which is on the Thursday in the morning. Brazil versus Argentina at 1:30 on Wednesday. As I said, Alisson, the immovable object against a stoppable force in Argentina. Moving on to AFCON, however, we're not quite as far developed in that tournament. A few of the groups are going to be decided as you're probably listening to the podcast itself. But Egypt, Mo Salah's Egypt through with Uganda. Madagascar has probably been the story of the tournament so far. Their first ever AFCON tournament. They beat Nigeria in the final game to top Group B. In other groups, which are concluding, as I said, throughout the week, Algeria looks set to go through, obviously led by Riyad Mahrez. Morocco also looking to go through with 6 points already. That will be concluded, again, by the time you've probably listened to this. Interesting, though, on Ivory Coast, Wilfried Zaha, who we know is arguably asking to leave Crystal Palace, or wanting to leave at least, rated at £100 million, but is being displaced by Max Gradle in the Ivory Coast starting lineup. So an interesting food for thought there, in the sense that Nicolas Pepe, who we haven't seen move yet, and Max Gradle, I think, of ex-Bournemouth fame.
And Leeds, perhaps, I believe, as well.
And Leeds, perhaps not Bournemouth fame, really, but being at Bournemouth, is keeping Zaha out of the side, which is interesting in itself. Group E and F are very close. Mali on 4 points, as long with Tunisia, Angola on 2. Cameroon on 4 points, Ghana and Benin on 2 as well. Obviously, some third place teams go through in that. So AFCON, definitely not too much to dive into because so much is yet to be played. But it looks like the teams led by Premier League superstars will be making an appearance in the knockout stages, and we might get more of the Mane-Mahrez showdowns that we saw earlier in the week.
We'll get Mane-Salah in the next round if Senegal finish second in their group.
Well, there you go. Mane, the Liverpool have quite a big presence in these tournaments, I'd say. Because
obviously Keita as well is subject of injury concerns now.
Yeah, I think Guinea are struggling to make it. I think they're on 4 points, so they might be one of the third place teams. But then you've also got, as I mentioned, Alisson not conceding for Brazil. Mm. So he's going to play a major part in the Copa America. And it could be, Salah and Mane, friends become rivals in AFCON. But the other tournament you might not even have had a clue that is going on is the Gold Cup. And we couldn't mention all the tournaments without mentioning the Gold Cup itself. But I have to be brutally honest, and I've not followed this as closely, but I will tell you who is in the semi-final of this. You have Haiti versus Mexico, which will be 3 a.m. on Wednesday. So you can watch the Copa America semi-final, Brazil-Argentina, and then be treated to a delightful Gold Cup action there, which is followed by a slightly earlier time on Thursday at 2 a.m., Jamaica versus USA. Obviously, Leon Bailey is playing for the Reggae Boys after that long, drawn-out process of who he would play for, despite never actually being able to play for any of the teams he was linked to be playing for. But finally in a Jamaica shirt, and you can watch him at 2 a.m. on Thursday. And the final tournament that is now concluded, hence why I'm concluding this section with it in my rapid roundup of tournament football, is the Under-21 European Championships. Spain equaled Italy's record of becoming 5-time champions at that level, and Dani Ceballos did not make history, despite me putting my neck out and saying that he would, despite finishing with the most take-ons, the most fouled ones, the most chances created, and being arguably the best player throughout the tournament. Just as you said, Will, about Lucy Bronze coming of age, is the incorrect term.
The Bronze Age.
Coming of the Bronze Age, yeah. Just as Lucy Bronze made a difference in the knockout stages, Fabian Ruiz of Napoli really took the game, especially in the final itself, with a brilliant opening goal, became the 6th Spanish player to win the Golden Player. And Colin Miller pointed out that the Real Betis...
Yeah, I was about to say, they produced both those players. when Dani Ceballos left for Real Madrid, they just brought Fabian into his place. Fabian was brilliant, then Fabian left for Napoli.
And also, the 2015 player of the tournament is William Carvalho for Portugal, who now finds himself at Real Betis.
Yeah.
So they know how to unidentify an under-21 Golden Player. And Gianluca Walschmidt of Germany finished the tournament with 7 goals, all of them pretty brilliant, as you'd expect from a left footer. Just excellent technique. And 7 goals is actually the most since the Golden Boot was officially recorded in 2000, is the most someone scored in a tournament. So well done to Gianluca Walschmidt. Well done to Spain. potentially well done to any of the four South American nations I've mentioned. And it's too early to say well done to anyone at AFCON because there's so many still to play. That is your little mini roundup. I challenge anyone to listen to that on 2x speed back and see if you can tell me what I said. But as a speed through, we're going to leave that there, have another break because I definitely need to intake some liquid. And we're going to be diving in to transfers. And with the success of the Atletico Madrid dive last week, Will has prepared another one that is very relevant this week. As promised, now we turn to the transfer section of the Squawker Talker football podcast. And there's no better place to start than with Juventus and their obsession with buying midfielders, well, for nothing, so not buying them at all. Attaining midfielders for free transfers. Adrian Rabiot is the latest to make the trip, obviously joining Aaron Ramsey as well. And this podcast being recorded on July the 1st means we've seen Aaron Ramsey in Juventus kit for the first time. Adrian Rabiot likely to be confirmed by the time you're listening to this again. So Will has taken it upon himself to investigate just why do Juventus love signing players for free if it wasn't self-explanatory already.
So unfortunately, your knowledge drop has pushed everything I was going to say in the section out of my head.
Oh.
But fortunately, I made notes. So as you've alluded to, Juventus are obviously known for signing top-level players for free. But I think there are two elements to their transfer activity under the current board, which has broadly existed since 2010, that I feel are overlooked, or at least crowded out by this perception of Juventus being amazing opportunists who snap up out-of-contract players.
Iker Casillas called them the Houdini of the transfer market.
Well, yeah.
So you about to challenge Iker Casillas?
No, not at all. I just want to quickly go over a couple of things that I feel like I said get crowded out by this sort of image that they've built of being like the sort of the bogeymen in the transfer market who are going to pinch your players for free. So around 30 players have actually left Juventus on free transfers in the four summers prior to this one. Mostly these are young players who haven't impressed enough on various loan spells. But others are aging stars put on short 1 or 2 year deals whose departures actually serve another purpose for Juventus by freeing up space on the wage bill. It's also worth considering the ruthlessness in how they, former GM Beppe Marotta let club legends such as Alessandro Del Piero quite a few years ago now go. for free, and also we saw Gianluigi Luigi Buffon depart more recently on a free. His contract was not renewed. Also, yes, they often sign aging stars, but I think that's quite common, really, because these players get to a certain age, they're out of contract, and they just shop around for a new club. And generally, when Juventus have done so, they let the players go the next season. So you can look at Fabio Cannavaro's second stint there, returning from Real Madrid, left the season after, I believe. Luca Toni did the same. Patrice Evra and Dani Alves more recently. So if you cut through all that noise, then the real unique pattern, as you said right at the top, is that they sign midfielders, specifically, out-of-contract midfielders, but they do so by taking advantage of attention at elite-level clubs. Attention between the midfielders and those clubs, often regarding some kind of contract situation. So it goes back really to 2011 when they signed Pirlo from AC Milan, interestingly due to tension with Max Allegri, who would be his manager for I think a season at Juventus. Next, Paul Pogba, tension between him and Ferguson. Mm-hmm. Mino Rola flavoured tension, perhaps. Found his route blocked to the first team after Paul Scholes came back out of retirement. Sami Khedira said he felt frozen out at Real Madrid due to his injury record. He joined in 2014, so that's 2 years after Pogba. And then more recently, we've seen Emre Can join from Liverpool. He reportedly wanted a release clause in his contract. Liverpool have a policy of not installing release clauses in their contracts because they don't want to set a precedent. And now Rabiot, who's like the sort of the best example of tension over a contract.
Someone that was banned or reportedly banned from training.
Well, I think it's on the record that he was banned after being spotted in a nightclub after the defeat to Man United. I think there was also a social media activity. Like, he liked to post blocking them. One of those.
You can't get away with that in the modern age.
Yeah.
And you can't say it's an accident, like Harry Maguire said as well. No, double liking is a double tapping is an accident.
I don't know. Well, it happens.
Yeah, it was. That was the point.
So, how do they attract these signings? It's quite difficult to say. I mean, the club can guarantee a league title in a way that only Bayern and PSG can. They also have a heritage PSG lack. Bayern, until fairly recently, seems to have had quite a settled 11. So I think that makes them less attractive for out-of-contract players, especially out-of-contract players who feel underappreciated at their current club. They don't want to find themselves in a situation where they're back up again. And so this is kind of me just speculating, but you could maybe, if you looked into it a bit more deeply, then you could sort of pick out how Juventus's sort of directors have massaged the squads to allow vacancies to pop up at just the right time when these players that have got their eyes on for some time become see their own contract expire, such as Ramsey. So maybe they'll decide not to sign a midfielder that summer in view of leaving that space open to pick up one for free. The following summer.
Well, I mean, isn't that why they're not looking for a goalkeeper now? Because a certain Spanish goalkeeper, his contract runs out in a year, doesn't it?
Could very well be. So, I mean, and if that does happen, then...
It's pretty much confident. That might be
their... you heard it here first.
Yeah. That might be their greatest conquest if they pull that one off.
Mm.
Well, there's reports that Buffon might reject Leeds and return to Juventus as well. To fill
out
that...
Out of his mind.
To fill that potential year gap.
Yeah. That would have been a gap for you in Paris, essentially.
Yeah.
But in terms of, like, the sort of, as you said, they're their best transfer yet, you'd have to say that Juventus consider their crowning achievement being a sort of project, you could say, that began with the signing of Pirlo in 2011 and culminated in that midfield that started the 2015 Champions League final, which was Paul Pogba, Andrea Pirlo, both of whom were free transfers, Claudio Marchisio, who was a youth product, and then Arturo Vidal, who they signed for $8 million from Bayer Leverkusen. But this pattern of signing disgruntled midfielders, you can find, takes its root in the 2011-12 season, which also happens to be when Antonio Conte was appointed. It also happens to be when they moved into their new stadium. It's easy to forget that before this streak of consecutive league titles, Juventus found themselves in a position where they'd only been back in Serie A several seasons after the Calciopoli scandal relegated them to the second tier, and because of that they technically hadn't won a title since 2003 if you just count the two they were stripped of. They're obviously, I think Agnelli's take is for many years now, been taking legal action against the Italian Football Federation to get them to reinstate those titles. But I mean, technically, they're not down as Juventus wins. So they had gone some time without winning the title. But at this point, they were unable to go out and sort of, you know, make the Cristiano Ronaldo signing that we saw them make last summer. But as we know, like, necessity is the mother of invention, and the guy tasked with resolving the tension between these two opposed necessities was Beppe Marotta, who had struggled in his first year with several signings. He can now be found fighting fires lit by Mauro Icardi at Inter Milan and the whole contract.
I thought you were going to say he'd become an actual fireman.
Where Antonio Conte has joined him once again, so they're teaming up. So.
And they've already employed the free transfer scheme by getting Godin from Atletico Madrid, who... Again, a defender that may be on his way out, but for a free transfer, that's a very decent pickup. And one of the reasons why Inter Milan might edge into that title race with Napoli.
With a coach who sort of made Juventus great again.
Yeah.
Marotta is a guy that's sort of largely credited with the construction of that midfield that I mentioned right at the top. Well, not right at the top, but sometime.
The Champions League final.
And by the time the first sort of iteration of this sort of building a midfield out of free transfers sort of disbanded when Pirlo and Vidal left in 2015, Juventus had won four straight Serie A titles, Coppa Italia, and had made, as I said, a Champions League final appearance. And that midfield, which started the 2015 Champions League final, was clearly at the front of Buffon's mind when he recently said of Rabiot that he is a mixture of the strength of Pogba, who's built like a wardrobe, the courage of Vidal, and potentially the dynamism of Marquisio. So yeah, just to outline that, that midfield of free transfers, you've got Khedira, who's still there. You've got Aaron Ramsey, obviously, they signed this summer technically, but we've known about that one for a while. Rabiot. Yep.
And Emre Can.
And Emre Can.
So you can have a diamond of £0.
Exactly.
Next season.
Obviously, Pjanic is the big signing that sort of sits there as well. Basically, I mean, it's a transfer sort of policy, if you can call it that, that was born out of necessity. But now that Juventus are in the position where they've got a bit more power, a bit more sway in the market, and a bit more attractive than they perhaps were back in 2011, they can revisit that policy but take it to the next level by just sort of, like I said, being the bogeyman of the transfer market and sort of, you know, essentially taking advantage and really cultivating situations where clubs lose their players for free, because a player's going to have it in mind. Well, players can talk to other clubs 6 months before their contract actually expires.
Which is what
so
happened
that
with Ramsey.
Then interferes with their thought process and their decision-making process as to whether they commit to the club or they leave on a free and get a signing on bonus.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if Juve are right now dripping poison into Hayes' ear. Don't renew. Don't go anywhere else. We'll come for you in a year. And I mean, then, you know, this guy, De Gea, wants to win titles. You know, Juve are going to come for him and say, look, you can come win titles with us, baby, every year.
Well, this is the thing as well. I think the important point here is that they're approaching all of these free transfer midfielders are usually 25 over. When you're approaching your peak years and you may have already built up a sort of CV of incredible performances that may have not borne any fruit.
Yeah, Pogba would potentially be the exception.
Yes.
Pirlo was 32 when he joined as well.
But so if you start at relatively that age where you're entering peak years, Aaron Ramsey, for example, has obviously won FA Cups with Arsenal and won trophies, but you said that allure of a league title, which Pep Guardiola mentions is the most difficult to win. Again, whether he's allaying the fact that he can't win the Champions League again is another discussion point. But it's that, as you've said, started out of necessity and it worked, and they built that midfield off it. And again, I just really like that point that now that domestic dominance that was built from that strategy has now taken, it's become its own monster in the sense that they can now say, well, look, we've won 8 league titles. You haven't got one yet. Just come and fill out our midfield a bit. So, as you said, someone else is already going to leave next season.
Another free signing, Kingsley Coman. Just look at the incredible trophy cabinet he's got on the back of having played for both Bayern and Juventus.
Well, yeah, he's done
and
both.
PSG, the three clubs that you can essentially.
Well, yeah, that's one. I think he's technically got one during his time at PSG, but obviously didn't play a main part in it. Went to Juventus and now cleaning up at Bayern. And part of that new and. We're talking about transfer strategies. Just a quick note, Bayern arguably, for the first time in a while, they won't have that set of 11 next season. A lot of transfers coming in, a lot of young players, and quite a French core at the middle of that Bayern team that will be interesting to follow in itself. Just a quick point on Juventus midfield, as carry on that. That's obviously, we now know exactly how it has been assembled, thanks to that. But Maurizio Sarri comes in, obviously gets to play with this. They've got about 7 midfielders on their books, not just the 3 midfielders.
Yeah, yeah.
Luca Pellegrini was signed last night, young left wing back from Roma. Again, another Serie A swap deal, some sort of profit margin explained in the press release there.
Serie A transfer market is basically like the Lannisters, isn't it, really? It's all a little bit...
It is highly active.
Yeah.
Whenever you go on the transfer market page for Italian clubs, it's... They're a lot bigger.
Yeah, a lot bigger, and no other league co-owns as many players as it seems. Yes. It's maybe gone out of fashion a bit, but that was always fun on Football Manager, trying to buy players, but having to buy 2 separate parts. Yeah. But how does this midfield line up next season then under Sarri? We know he's probably going to play 4-3-3. He's now got an incredible mix of midfielders to try and blend together. We might actually see some rotation.
I think you got Pjanic is at the base.
Yes.
I think Rabiot is a different kind of shuttle. And I think Ramsey, I think you can play Rabiot and Ramsey basically. And one of them they can both sort of be the shuttle and they can both sort of be the hamstring. I think they can alternate. Right. There's also Blaise Matuidi, who is the dream Alan. So it might actually be, I mean, they've got so many options, but it might just be Pjanic at the base, Rabiot and Matuidi, I think, in midfield. Because Matuidi, actually, thinking about
Ramsey leaving to not even get a starting
place. I mean, the thing is, I don't think he will. I mean, you look at their best team, he's probably not in it. He's not better than Rabiot. And
what if he becomes a Ramdeuter, a Ramsey Deuter?
I mean, false nine. Who's their striker? Their number nine. They don't really have one, do they?
And
they
got Higuain's back.
And you've got Cristiano, who's obviously a great goal scorer, playing in left wing. So you could see maybe Ramsey is the false nine and he comes deep in. Because he's great in attack, Aaron Ramsey. So
I think he's not back to goal. I think he likes having the play in front.
No, I know.
Necessarily.
We'll see.
But this is what I mean: is Juventus now can have three man midfield essentially because Bentancur, obviously with Uruguay,
forgot about him as
brilliant
well.
Player.
And also another one not to forget about, and the noise is coming out of Manchester United that there is a sort of 1% chance of a sale of Paul Pogba, but there were reports from very credible sources that Paratici, who used to be sort of Pep Emerita's sort of right-hand man, I think, on the board of directors, or not directors, the sort of, you know, the general management of the club, travelled over to England for talks over the signing of Pogba. I mean, so Rabiot is there in a free. Is that necessarily sort of put an end to their chase of Pogba?
I think that is, because if you look at it as well, I think their big money is going to go on De Ligt,
but
right?
Those links that's... sort of existed at the same time, and they always...
Yeah, but then I suppose if you pick up Rabiot on a free, is that not a sort of admission that he's your backup option? Like, he was Barcelona's backup option. If they couldn't get Frankie de Jong, it was like, oh, Rabiot. And they got Frankie de Jong.
They're
like,
supposed to have sort of offered him a contract and might even owe Rabiot money.
Yeah, basically.
Because they pulled out.
But then it was like, Barcelona. Oh, okay, no, see you later. We've got Frankie now. So I think that if Pogba is going anywhere, which I do think he will do, it's going to be Real Madrid. I think that's the big one. It'll just cost them a lot of money. They have to sell players first. I do think Juve will... where is they going to get De Ligt? So, you know, that'll be where their money goes this summer. Because obviously they're picking up all these players on the free. And so you bring De Ligt in, that's because Bonucci hasn't come back from Milan the same
player.
Also,
again, these are really tenuous, but I saw Bonucci's name starting to crop up with potential moves away.
Yeah, I mean, he's not been the same player since he sort of moved to Milan.
Well, yeah, once you sully your reputation by doing that one-stop shop, sort of one season, switched away to Milan, oh no, wait. Give me back. AC Milan obviously having to remove themselves from the Europa League to avoid any other financial sanctions. But as we mentioned, Paul Pogba there, it makes sense to move on from Juventus's incredible assembly of balanced, bountiful midfield options into Man United's lack of
everything
midfield options. And just Man United in general, because we've seen... Two signings have been made, right-sided signings, arguably. Wan-Bissaka, the latest, becoming one of the most expensive English players ever, which necessarily isn't a great thing because Danny Drinkwater is one of those, alongside Andy Carroll as well. So it remains to be seen. But in general, it's a positive signing. It fits with their apparent new transfer direction in which they will be signing young players. With a hunger, I believe is the word Ole Gunnar Solskjaer used when describing Aaron Wan-Bissaka and also Daniel James, and Ed Woodward. Somehow, who did this? An email has been leaked that said that he promises exciting new signings and that Man United are working frantically behind the scenes to press forward in building a new squad for Ole Gunnar Solskjaer.
I'll tell you what, man. That dude
darn the person that leaked that email.
He must be devastated with how that got out.
That dude can PR with like nobody's business. You know, whether he can deliver on it, I don't know. But I mean, you can't argue with the way he talks the talk. Wan-Bissaka, phenomenal, right? Okay, I know he played Palace are more defensive than Man United, but Wan-Bissaka by himself had 190 tackles last season in the Premier League, 84 interceptions, 61 dribbles completed, 129 clearances.
You keep looking at the wrong tackle metric as well, Mo.
Apologies.
You could be making these numbers even more impressive.
Ashley Young, Diogo Dalo, and Antonio Valencia together as three players played about 500 more minutes all told than Wan-Bissaka did. He actually had about 3,100. They have all together about 3,500, 3,600. 50 tackles, 70 interceptions, 31 dribbles, 94 clearances. He basically beats them in all end up by himself. Now, I know Palace are more defensive than Man United, but...
Yeah, but I bet if you'd started looking at chances created,
well,
people would be using that against you. Because that's the argument, isn't it? Yeah. Wan-Bissaka, we have this ultimate 1v1 defending dual master that no one can beat apart from Leroy Sané twice. Mm. Only nine players have done it. Leroy Sané, the only person to do it twice, is my favourite little stat that came out of that.
Also the only person to dribble past Van Dijk, right?
Exactly. So Leroy Sané, no wonder he's worth 80 million, apparently.
Worth more than that in this market, surely. He's not a great attacker going forward. We haven't seen him in a team that dominates the ball play well, because that's not been his strength. But two things is, one is obviously he's 21. There's a lot of potential for him to grow into that player. Secondly, even if he never does, to be perfectly honest, I don't know that he has to. He's a fantastic defender, and what Man United need more than anything right now is fantastic defenders. You can't play well on Solskjaer's whole football is sitting deep, playing on the break, right? You can't do that if your defense is a sieve. You know, if your defense leaks chances, leaks goals like for fun, then you can't be a defensive side. You can't play on the counter attack. And there will be games where United have a lot of the ball. Maybe Wan-Bissaka will not be the most useful in attack. But the thing is, even if all he learns how to do is make overlaps, and he only has the energy and dynamism to do that, that in itself is going to open up space for the winger, whoever the winger ahead of him is. You know, so just having a fullback that has the energy to move forward and constantly make overlaps, but also the energy to then get back and defend is huge. Mm. You could even do an asymmetric thing, I think I suggested before, where you side with him across into a sort of semi-back three, and then you just let Luke Shaw be a left winger. You know, so there's options. And first and foremost, he's a good defender, man. I don't have any of those. But I would argue he's as good a defender as Victor Lindelof. Victor Lindelof is the only Man United defender that you'd class as good. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, Edward Wood's like, oh, more young signings, more promising young signings. I mean, I would, if I had to Hessen, United need at least three or four more players. Mm. If Pogba and Lukaku go, they both need to be replaced.
Yeah, and the thing is with Man United is, even if they didn't make those big sales, what Ed Woodward has done is allowed them to be able to make those signings. It seems like they have the money to do it.
Oh, they've got a lot of money. And I think if you look at this, they need three positions really quite desperately. They need a centre-back, they need a defensive midfielder, and they need a central midfielder. Now, I would assume they're only going to get two of those because United have signed four players per summer every year, and that seems to be the modus operandi. At centre-back, I think you have to look at Koulibaly. I don't think you can look beyond him. I know Harry Maguire's been mooted, and he's very, very good. I'm a big fan of Harry Maguire. But for the money you're spending on Harry Maguire, which is rumoured to be about 80 million, just spend the extra 30 and get Koulibaly. Honestly, there is definitely a £30 million difference between the two of them. I would argue even more. Koulibaly is 110% the leader you need at the back for Man United. I don't know if Harry Maguire is. Secondly, the second position, defensive midfield. You've been linked with Sean Longstaff and Declan Rice. I think either of those you get is you're getting a project midfielder. Longstaff probably will be a lot cheaper and maybe easier to mould. I mean, I've read comparisons to Michael Carrick. I don't know how true that really is, but he'll be working with Carrick.
The things people forget about Longstaff as well, is I think he didn't even clock 1,000 minutes in the end.
He's very raw.
He looked very promising in those 900 plus minutes, but his knee injury robbed him of the end of the season. So now there's a very short sample size.
A player who has played in a team that clocks up quite low possession stats as well. So,
To me, Rice would be the safer bet out of those two. Apparently, Weigl is available on the market. Julian Weigl, maybe try and resurrect him. I mean, if anyone could resurrect him, it would be Michael Carrick. He has a Carrick-esqueness about him. And then central midfield, I mean, they've been linked with, God knows, whoever they've been linked with, Saul, just about everyone you can think of, James Maddison, although I think they should sign James Maddison when Paul Pogba goes. I don't think you can play Maddison and Pogba together, really, kind of conflicting. But I think once Pogba goes, you spend 60 million on that guy. Here you go, Leicester, give us James Maddison, please. But before then, the man, for me, that they need to sign almost as much as Koulibaly is Danny Ceballos. Real Madrid don't want him, for whatever reason. He's everything United needed more. He's not attacking midfielder. He's not central midfielder. Not defensive midfielder. He's just a midfielder. He can tackle. He can handle himself defensively. He can carry the ball forward with at his feet. He can pass. He can score goals. He can literally do everything you want in a midfielder. It's absurd that
which Real is what Paul Pogba can do.
Yeah,
and they've not done very well with him.
Yes, well, yeah, but that's also in part because I don't think Paul Pogba can defend in the same way that Ceballos can defend, partly because Paul Pogba is 6'3". He can't run around like that. He'll be out of gas in like half an hour, 45 minutes. Ceballos being shorter, having a less smaller physical frame, does enable him to move around a lot more, I think. I mean, that's just a fact. But also, I think he's more of a... He's less likely to be as streaky as Pogba because I think ultimately United would rather not sell Paul Pogba. But I think the fact of the matter is, he doesn't want to play in the Europa League again. Whereas Danny Ceballos just wants to play. He said, this year I want continuity. This will be my year. So I think getting him, offering him continuity, offering him the starring role at the heart of the midfield for United, I think he would absolutely shine. Next to Paul Pogba, if Pogba stays, if Pogba goes, next to James Maddison, I think he's everything.
What about Bruno Fernandes?
I'm
sorry.
Bruno Fernandes.
That was the proper Portuguese
30 goals. 30 goals is nothing to sniff at, but he's 70 million euros for a guy who scored. And we don't know how well that translates to outside the Portuguese league. Portuguese league can be very misleading. It's just like the Dutch league in terms of goal scoring. Look at Vincent Janssen. Plenty of players in Portugal who looked amazing. Renato Sanches, to name one, didn't translate that to outside the Portuguese league. Bruno Fernandes is 24. If he was that good, wouldn't he?
Remember, he was in Serie A.
Yeah, he was.
Been there all the time.
He learned a new name.
Sporting bought him from Sampdoria, who are brilliant in the transfer market themselves. Because they were like, this guy's Portuguese and he's really good.
Yeah, he scored 16 goals in his first season, 31, 32 in his second season. Yeah. So he's obviously, he's great, but ultimately, I don't think you could. Here again, he's an attacking midfielder, so you don't buy him when Pogba is still at the club. You can't play him and Pogba together. It's the same kind of thing. If once you sell Pogba, do you buy Maddison or Bruno Fernandes? I mean, that depends.
They're going to be a similar price.
Yeah, a similar price. It depends on what you want, I guess. Maddison will give you much more creativity, which I think arguably is what Man United need more. Chance creation, set pieces, that sort of thing. Bruno Fernandes scores you goals, but if you get the midfield right, then everyone else will score you goals anyway. So
there you go. Wrapped up. And Bruno Fernandes, this will bring us to our last transfer bit, which will be a bit briefer. Bruno Fernandes, often said to be the Portuguese Frank Lampard, because of his goal-scoring record and his ability to arrive in the box late and also just skim shots from 30 yards out that don't look clean, but just find their way into the net. Obviously, Frank Lampard isn't doing that anymore himself. He's now asking other players to do so. And it's been reported on the morning of the podcast recording that Derby have said, we've let Frank Lampard go and talk to Chelsea to try and conclude this deal. It seemed, the way the tweet read, seemed very resigned, like, just hurry up and do it. We want to move on. Because I don't think you usually see a team so public in their reporting of their manager being tapped up.
Every stage of it has just sort of had its own official statement.
So I think
Mel Morris, the director, also went on TalkSport after the first statement and said it's not a done deal yet.
Yeah,
which is an odd thing to say.
Which was odd.
Really, you've gone past the point of no return.
Because if Chelsea are offering Lampard the job, he is going to take it. That sort of thing. No matter his time that he enjoyed at Derby and the progress they may have made, someone that is Chelsea's all-time top scorer is going to jump at the chance to manage them. And the key part of Lampard is he's bringing Jody Morris with him. Who, when Conte was in charge, if you listen to Jody Morris and the way he spoke about the academy, was very much like, I've got an incredible bunch here, but they're not going to play. He was quite blunt about how his treble-winning side, under-18s level, did not have much of the chance. This Lampard introduction potentially is the change. And Mo, I know you wrote a piece about how this gives Chelsea the chance to reinvent themselves because they're getting an inexperienced manager, not a serial winner by any means, as a manager, of course. And they will have to trust in a lot of the youth because we don't know what's happening with the transfer ban. Kovacic has been signed. I don't think it's been announced just yet, actually. But there seems to have been some sort of leak, and it's been widely reported that because he was already registered.
Their official club app sort of screenshots have been posted on social media.
It's the exact same process of when Solskjaer was leaked as permanent manager. They had an article on their website.
So frequently. I mean, obviously, you've got to prepare all this content in advance.
Yeah, well, it's the same with the beautiful Arsenal kit being leaked on the Adidas, then making the YouTube video live. So we know it happens. So it looks like Kovacic will be at least one body. Obviously, he's not a new body because they had him last season. Higuain, as we mentioned earlier, when talking about Juventus, his incredible free transfers. He'll be going back. Oh, and conveniently, lines up with Sarri once again. It wouldn't put us past him for some sort of Jorginho bid to be made, but that looks unlikely.
Yeah, not with Emish, there were too many already.
But that's what I mean. Chelsea arguably had the midfield created already, and this is what I was going to talk about specifically, which isn't necessarily transfer-based player-wise. As we said, there's a transfer ban. We don't know what's going to happen yet. But how does Frank Lampard assemble this Chelsea midfield? And I thought it was good to consider sort of the two seasons or spells at Chelsea where he enjoyed his best football as possible inspirations for that. So you obviously have when Jose Mourinho first came over and they broke every record in the first season. That was very much a 4-3-3. And Jose Mourinho used a 4-3-3 because he said everyone's still playing 4-4-2. this gives me a man advantage in midfield, mm-hmm. and I'm just going to overload everyone. Obviously, this is when the Makelele role was born, and you could see Lampard answering the call and the plead of the general public to return Kante into this more anchorman role, which necessarily I quite enjoyed him in his new role. I don't think Jorginho was as bad as was made out potentially, and again, we saw with a lot of the stats that came out at the end of the season, Jorginho actually did put out quite an impressive output in certain areas, and there is argument though that this was because of the possession based style. Lampard, I don't think, will impose such a possession heavy style on this Chelsea team. Again, the Derby side, a lot of the criticism that's been sent towards Frank Lampard's way from the onlookers that followed the Championship and Derby seasons, that you didn't really know how he played. So this led me on to, it won't be such a rigid 4-4-3 as that Mourinho midfield, because again, Chelsea do have a lot of midfielders. The one midfielder that would have been so exciting to see used properly was Ruben Loftus-Cheek, and we don't know how long he's going to be out for. So someone there that could have been used as the new Frank Lampard, under Frank Lampard, etc., is going to be missing.
Do you think that influenced the Kovacic thing? I think if he was fit, do you think they would have just said 45 in for Kovacic, now you're all right?
No, I think they needed to get a player. So the fact that the transfer ban's looming is... Again, Kovacic was criticised because he doesn't score goals.
Yes. Yeah.
But what he does do is retain the ball excellently, and it's overlooked. You mentioned Danny Ceballos. The word press resistant is thrown around a lot. Kovacic will wriggle his way out of every area.
That's true.
And when Real Madrid signed Danny Ceballos, it was the same level of confusion that is going on now with Real Madrid, in the sense that they've got Danny Ceballos, they had Marcus Llorente. Why are you buying more midfielders? Well, and they bought Danny Ceballos.
It was Luka Modric's heir, and then they just never actually replaced
it. But it was like, you've bought Danny Ceballos, which is what Kovacic can do if you allow him to. So Real Madrid and themselves are confusing.
Yes.
However, Chelsea, with their transfer ban, needed, I think, just an extra bodies, because it's a lot to ask to all of a sudden Mason Mount come back from Derby, again, be used as Frank Lampard's main man, was used in that number eight role. But the point I was getting around to was that Lampard's Derby and his constant switching of formations was reminiscent of Ancelotti's management of Chelsea during his other incredible season in 2009-10, in which Ancelotti switched from a 4-3-2-1 Christmas tree formation, a diamond which was used right at the beginning and was successful, which relied massively on the fullbacks, which again, Chelsea, we don't know if they have strong enough fullbacks to do that. And then he eventually started switching to just a more basic 4-2-3-1. And all of those formations, a 4-3-1-2 was used by Lampard at Derby, so another inversion, were used last season at Derby. And I think Chelsea, the midfielders they have available, I've got a feeling Ross Barkley will see a lot of minutes under Frank Lampard, because he's English, he should be approaching his peak performance levels at the age of 25. Danny Drinkwater, who is still there, may be used, because it was quite clear, Sarri said, he plays in a two-man midfield. I don't play a two-man midfield. If Frank Lampard returns to a 4-2-3-1 and doesn't fancy Jorginho, we could see Danny Drinkwater play alongside Kante again in a 4-2-3-1. And then you have the likes of Christian Pulisic. The number 10 role, we're not sure. Pulisic can play there himself. Hudson-Odoi returning from injury. And then Willian and Pedro are obviously still at the club. One thing, again, they lack, the reason why I don't think we'll see the diamond, Tammy Abraham, Olivier Giroud is obviously an untested partnership, but it's arguably not the elite level you need to employ that consistently, especially with the fact that if those two don't play, they don't have anyone else. So depth becomes a thing. So Frank Lampard, I feel, it looks like he's taking charge. I've got a feeling we're going to see a lot of different formations next season. It'll be the complete antithesis to Sarri, in the sense that we knew exactly what was happening. We knew what minute he was going to make a sub. Lampard could play a different midfield every game as he tries to juggle the injuries, the potential and the lack of signings, as well as giving minutes to players that perhaps aren't ready for Champions League football. I think it's almost gone under the radar that Lampard's going to be thrown straight into Champions League football next season.
Thrown straight into Super Cup against Liverpool.
Of course.
Chance to win a trophy. It was like maybe a second game.
And in the same way that Di Matteo sort of got that job and managed to win the Champions League and then it fell off. But the major thing is there's injuries, there are young players to come through, and the formation itself depends on other areas of the pitch which perhaps aren't as strong. and perhaps not Champions League level yet. But Frank Lampard's Chelsea midfield will be interesting, to say the least. And as I said, it will be the complete different to Maurizio Sarri, in the sense that we might actually see all of their midfielders play throughout the season rather than just four. But that will be that. And the last bit of bonus content for this week's Squawker Talker will be a return to the Copa America. And we've asked Mo to tell us why Chile just keep winning it. So, as I said, a return back to some of the tournament football, but more of an overlook of perhaps one of the most overperforming national teams and most intriguing of the last few years. Chile, obviously, on course to win another Copa America title. Alexis Sanchez is a different player, completely the opposite to what we've seen at Manchester United this season. And Mo, given his interest in Argentina specifically, and obviously has told us why Lionel Messi is not reached the heights that his talent promises before. A lot of focus of Brazil during the last World Cup. We tasked you with telling the listeners of the Squawker Talker football podcast a little bit about why Chile are so successful in the Copa and how they're on the verge of making or at least equaling history, I think. So over to you. Address this how you would like to address it.
Well, listeners of the Squawker Talker football podcast, I'm not quite going to go all full Will Hall here. I'm not that man. I'm not that impressive. But yeah, just to take, basically, as Jack says, Lionel Messi obviously hasn't won the Copa America, lost two finals in a row, missed a penalty in the, was the only Argentine to score a penalty in the 2015 final, and then missed the first penalty in the 2016 final, which ultimately was one of the two misses and cost Argentina the trophy. Then had a big emo fit, retired, grew a beard. So it was the whole thing. Dyed his hair blonde as well. It was traumatic. Anyway, he's not alone in his failures in the Copa America, because, you know, there's this whole thing of who's the greatest player of all time. Is Messi genuinely up there? You people comparing him and his feats to Messi, to Maradona and to Pele. Well, you can compare his failures to Maradona and Pele either, because Maradona and Pele have never won the Copa America either. You know, Pele only entered it once.
I think they won the World Cup though.
Yeah. All right.
Quite a few.
All right.
This is a Chile deep dive.
I'm just saying, this is the point. You know, Chile, Copa America is something you would expect. Oh, Brazil and Argentina are going to have the most wins. They're going to be the dominant sides. But Uruguay have won it more times than anyone else. They won it 15 times. Argentina have 14. Brazil only have 8. Now, most of those were recent. Brazil weren't historically very good. Like I said, Pele only won it once in 59. No, I didn't even win it, sorry. He only even came close once in 59 after they won the World Cup in Sweden. They finished second, Pele scored 8 goals. So this is not a competition that the big sides dominate. But then Chile, equally, no. They never won it before. They'd finished runners-up 4 times in 55, 56, 79 and 87. In 1979, they lost it on goal difference. Oh. Because they lost the first leg against Paraguay in the final to 3-0, won the second leg 1-0, and then they had a playoff which was 0-0, so it went to goal difference and they lost because they lost the first leg. So they've never really been historically a dominant side. Even though they had a great team in the 90s with Marcelo Salas and even Zamorano, of course everyone remembers them. But they never really did anything. And then they had this generation growing, right? This Alexis Sanchez, Arturo Vidal, Gary Medel, these really talented guys. And they got Marcelo Bielsa as the coach, obviously, in 2009, I do believe. And he took them over. And he's phenomenal. Everyone who knows Bielsa, phenomenal. Bielsa probably announced himself to the world, really, with that Chile side. I mean, he was obviously manager of Argentina in 2002, but they were a mess. And no one really paid attention to them. In the World Cup when they got dumped out by England, and he had a weird thing about long hair. He's a very strange man. Everyone knows this. So Chile, he revolutionised Chile because he obviously had them play his classic style of football, but because it's international football and you're only playing once every however many games, you're playing like, 15 games maximum a year, you can play Bielsa's kind of frenetic football and it's not going to wear you out. Your bones aren't going to turn to powder. And so they were this dynamic, beautiful side to watch. Loads of technical players who weren't necessarily the most amazing players, but they worked. I mean, Leeds fans will know this. Bielsa works his players hard. He makes them run and run and run and run. And the Chile players were more than happy to run and run and run and run. Even the star players were workhorses. That's the thing. Obviously, everyone's always been like, oh, I'd love to see Bielsa manage Argentina again or whatever. But, you know, how would Bielsa handle star players that aren't going to run all day, you know? like Messi, Aguero, those kind of guys, you know? He needs players that will just constantly run, and Chile had that. Obviously, they reached the round of 16 in 2010, lost to Brazil, because big physical sides that could just tear through his tiny sides were always his, have always been Bielsa's kryptonite. That's what happened. Then he walked away, and Jorge Sampaoli took over for him, his assistant. And Sampaoli took them a step further, made them just as much fun to watch. But again, they got undone by Brazil in 2014. So you're thinking, what can they do to get over the hump? And what they did was, they just started playing dirty, basically. In 2015, there were normal Chile in the groups, and then knockout rounds came, and they're playing Uruguay, and you're thinking, they're going to lose this game. And then they just start doing, they start playing defensively, they start tackling. They were at home in 2015, right? So the refs were kind of giving them the home advantage. They took advantage of it, you know. There's the famous incident of obviously, Gonzalo Jara famously, assaulted Edison Cavani. There's no other way to say it, really. They played dirty. They played very dirty. They won
that was the definition of dirty.
Yeah, literally, yeah. I mean, they won that game, I think, 1-0. You know, they played dirty. They played defensive. They got to the final against Argentina. And again, you're thinking, because Argentina were very good in that tournament. They rolled over Paraguay 6-1 in the semi-finals. You're thinking, okay, Messi's having revenge 2014. Here we go. And you thought maybe Chile is going to match. Maybe it's going to be a really exciting final. And it was in Chile. Were like, no. They sat two banks of four behind the ball and they just soaked up. And because Argentina were kind of a mess, even despite their quality, they just couldn't break them down. Chile were dirty. They were tackling, making nasty fouls. Everyone thought they were going to play, they're going to be really funny, exciting head-to-head with Argentina. But they didn't. They sat back, they defended deep. And this is what made the difference, man, because they had Claudio Bravo playing at Barcelona at the time, was playing really, really well. That really stabilised things. Bosajor, Birmingham City legend, Wigan legend, Jean Bosajor was playing out of his mind. Charles Aranguiz, Maurizio Isla, I think we're still at Udinese at that time, I can't remember. And they had these great players. I mean, Eduardo Vargas was one. He really came into the fore in those tournaments.
But this is the thing with Chile. The reason why we wanted to focus on this is because not only are they on the verge of winning three Copa America titles in a row, they are doing it with, again, and then this really parallels nicely with the US women's team that we mentioned at the beginning. Claudio Bravo has been sort of taken out of the squad because of his injuries.
And it's replaced by the best goalie from Argentina.
So again, more sweet irony in the Copa America. But if Claudio Bravo were fit, he would have been in the squad. They would have also had seven centurions in this squad.
Yeah.
Chile have built, this will be the last hurrah of this Chile side, arguably. We're already seeing signs that Alexis Sanchez might be Birmingham.
There might be a Copa America next year, so maybe hold fire on that.
So the band will be almost like an Anchorman, where they sound the horn, and all the Chile, and John Bosajor, Mauricio Isi, Gonzalo Jara, Gary Medel, all coming back. And those players have had stints in the Premier League and almost been cult heroes for the bizarreness of those stints. Gary Medel, obviously, at Cardiff, as you mentioned, yeah. John Bosajor. But when they come together in this collective Chile side... and again, Alexis Sanchez is the microcosm of this now, could not kick a ball straight for Manchester United, and has been, again, arguably one of the player of the tournaments at the Copa America.
I mean, yeah, the only one whose club form hasn't diminished is Arturo Vidal, really. Yeah. He's still doing the business. And he, again, you know, I mean, although, again, he looked pretty out of his sorts at Anfield, and then look at him now, he's phenomenal. It wouldn't surprise me if Chile won. Because Brazil don't look at their best. You know, Firmino's no-look pass completely cursed him. He was awful in the last round.
He missed the penalty, didn't he?
Yeah, just atrocious. Really bad all game.
So he is the most paradoxical forward in the world.
Good job we picked him out to focus on in the last episode.
So they're relying on Coutinho and Firmino to produce some magic. I mean, who knows if they can. Argentina are just a disaster. Mm. Lautaro has done well so far to help them out. Will Messi finally wake up? Because it's Brazil. Who the hell knows? Honestly, you can't predict what the hell Argentina are going to do. And then Peru were lucky to get through. They should have got battered by Uruguay.
I forgot to mention in my speedy roundup, because it was so speedy that Uruguay had goals disallowed in that game.
Two disallowed from VR. I would imagine Peru will probably get... Chile will beat Peru, right? I would very, very confident of that. They'll make the final. Whether they can beat Brazil or Argentina, I mean, honestly, it wouldn't surprise me that they know how to... They can play beautiful football, but they also, after proving in 2015, 2016, they can play defensively. They can be really spoily, and they can then... And they've got the kind of players who can be spoilers, chase after the ball all day long, make the game so horrible to watch, but then also have the quality to suddenly go, bam, turn it on, win the game in a second.
That's the difference, isn't it? You've got Charles Aránguiz there, who's leading the assists for Copa America with three.
Magnificent.
And if they do set up a final against Argentina,
yeah,
then win it, they'll have equaled the record set by Argentina, which is three Copa Americas in a row. I did another air quotes thing which isn't great.
And they'll have equaled that record by beating them three times in a row.
The Champions League, yes, used to be called something else. Used to have a different format.
Yeah. But still, that would be amazing because they would have beaten them three times in a row. And also interesting because if they do, there's no Higuain in the squad. So who's going to miss the 1v1 this time? Mm.
Who will you be able to blame?
another thing that could happen three times in a row, you mentioned Eduardo Vargas, is the two tournaments previous Golden Boot
yeah.
And he's currently right at the top of the goal scoring standings as we speak.
Jake said there's like nine players on two, so just
I think 10 have scored two, obviously some of them are out.
Exactly.
But Eduardo Vargas, just to finish on that, he is the second top scorer in Chile's history, behind only Alexis Sanchez, who fits the bill. Alexis Sanchez, remember, is the most capped and the all-time top scorer. He is a legend of this Chile team. And again, that speaks to the volume of the quality we know he has.
Yeah.
But it seems now that do you remember before the last season, we were like, Alexis Sanchez has finally had a break. Yeah. We will see him explode for Man United.
Yeah.
Perhaps what Alexis Sanchez needs is the injection of the Copa America into his veins.
He needs to be exhausted.
He needs to be running on empty, but running on the fact there's that brilliant photo of Alexis Sanchez holding two Copa America trophies, I think, from the last time they won it. Or maybe it was the Golden Ball in the tournament and the Copa America trophy. And it just seems
he had his hands full. Basically.
Yeah, he had his hands full with loads of trophies. And it just seems that this Chile side, and perhaps it's South American sides in general, that they sort of instill a spirit of...
It's patriotism. It's not a cynical kind of patriotism like you would expect in the global north, as it were. In the global south, especially in South America, there's a lot of genuine, and I don't know how much of it is maybe cynical or nasty, but it just seems like a pure, like they love the country. Like Uruguayans, like Luis Suarez, you know, it's easy to laugh at him, and it's quite fun to laugh at him, to be honest.
Yeah.
But, you know, he loves his country. And the reason he did the handball against Ghana is because he would literally die for it. If you asked him to die for his country, he would. So it's... Yeah, and Alexis Sanchez, he loves Chile. Arturo Vidal, they love their country. They would do anything for their country. And I think seeing them succeed with it, I mean, because this is the first, Chile are tiny. Chile, as a country, they've never won, there's two Copa Americas, the last two in the world. You know, that's such an impressive achievement. And the fact that they could actually make it three in a row when everything about them that made them great in 2015 is gone now. Sampaoli's gone. The players are older. They're not, you know, there's no real replacements coming through, as it were, by way of.
Well, that's what I mean. It's a tiny country. So you have to give Jean Bajajor 100 caps because you don't have another dynamic left wing back that can seemingly do everything.
I mean, Valdivia's now gone. You know, their amazing number 10 that was so important to them. So they don't even have that sort of brilliance to bring off the bench. It's such a story. I hope they do it, to be honest.
Well, this is the thing. As I said, we had to fit it into this one because we don't know what will happen. This week is full of semi-finals that you need to be following. And as I said, if you can stay up for it, definitely try and do
so. If you're hard enough.
Because who doesn't enjoy Eduardo Vargas setting the international scene alight?
Scoring from outside the area.
Exactly. So with that little touch on why Chile are so blooming brilliant at the Copa America, we're going to have to call an end to this week's episode of the Squawker Talk of Football podcast. That leads me to say thank you to the Squawker Talk of Football podcast guest, Mohamed Butt. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Stay with me, folks. 1:30 a.m. on Wednesday in the...
I'm sure Mohamed will be tweeting viciously as the games go
trying to stay awake.
Will, who may be asleep for those games, I imagine. I don't know if you're planning to stay up.
I think I'll play it by ear.
Play it by ear, there you go. So thank you for joining us, and thank you again for incredible analysis of transfers, tournaments, everything. Expect the same next week, and thank you. Goodbye.